right, we have one case remaining on our 10 o'clock docket. If the clerk will please announce counsel for Carmel v. State. All right, and before we begin, we just wanted to advise counsel that, of course, the court has read the briefs, the extensive procedural history and background on this case. So if you would try to focus your comments on what exactly we are supposed to be doing here today on this remand, I think that would help the court. Mr. Nouse.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. Your honors, I am, I think, the fourth appointed attorney on this case, so I drew the black bean and I'm here. In this particular instance, of course, as the court knows, this was remanded originally from the United States Supreme Court. And we have taken the position, and I want to go ahead and address one of the things the state has raised. They have raised that they feel this appeal is limited to only four counts. I would point out to the court that in the Supreme Court decision, they didn't simply reverse and remand as to 4 points. They reversed and remanded the entire case. If they had wanted to remand only on 4 points, I assume that they would have said the Fort Worth Court of Appeals is affirmed as to all other points and we are simply reversing this. That's not what occurred. In this particular instance, what we've suggested to the court is that when I read the Supreme Court case, they went into a great deal of historical detail going through the Fenwick case that came out of England, I think, in 1600s. The thing that I thought was interesting about that is that they made an analogy in that Fenwick involved treason and required 2 eyewitnesses. And in this case, it requires cooperation. What Supreme Court did is they said that 3807 is a sufficiency issue, not simply competence of the witness. And in this particular instance, one of the things that I think that the court said that is most significant is they noted that cooperation, which is one of the issues that we brought up here, was raised by the appellant, by Carmel, in the first case before this court. And it was not, there was nothing, never addressed by the state at that time. And what the court said, if I can lay my hands on it real quick, is they said that they assumed that since there was an issue raised as cooperation, that there was none, that for their purposes, they assumed there was none either for that brief. In addition to that, one of the things that is very significant is that the state at that time in argument raised to the court, which the state said was an accurate account of Texas law. The court stated that a trial court's failure to comply with the requirements of Article 3807 results not in a remand for a new trial, but in the reversal of a conviction and remand for entry of an order of acquittal, citing Scoggins. And they stated at oral argument, Texas agreed that the foregoing is an accurate description of Texas law. So our first position here is that what should have occurred on the remand and probably didn't happen because the appellant had ineffective assistance of counsel, had no brief. Nothing was ever raised in any way for him on his behalf at that time. So I think had he had competent counsel, and perhaps I think, you know, it's certainly said that if you change attorneys during litigation, that's like changing deck chairs on the Titanic, but In this particular instance where you had none, maybe he's come up a few decks. In this particular instance, I think had he had competent counsel, they would have raised exactly the issue that I'm raising right now, and that is that the court should have simply entered an order of acquittal on counts 7 through 10 because there was no cooperation. Cooperation, as I've stated, and what we've raised as a first issue is that the state waived that. They waived it not only on appeal, but they waived it in the first appeal because cooperation was raised as an issue that there was none. And then what they said is nothing. The first time they ever raised cooperation was in the appeal to the United States Supreme Court. So they didn't raise it to this court. They didn't raise it until in the petition for writ of certiorari. They didn't raise it in oral argument until it got all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. And I've cited the court to some case law of the United States Supreme Court that says that is a waiver, and they don't even allow oral argument generally in that regard.
So are you saying the state waived this issue on cooperation because they didn't contest it, or are you saying that there was no evidence of cooperation? In other words, it seems like maybe you're shifting the burden. It seems like it would be a defensive issue to say, well, we want this issue preserved so that and or reversed on appeal because there was no evidence of cooperation and the statute at that time did require it. It seems like it's more of a defensive issue, I guess.
Well, of course, as I recall in reading the original briefs, I think appellate did raise it. Okay. The state's basic position back at that time is we don't need cooperation because 3807 in the amended version didn't require it, simply because if it was outcry within a year or over a year, within a year, then they didn't need cooperation. And so here, of course, what the Court of Appeals and basically up to the United States Supreme Court said is that no, 3807, the older version applied. And one of the things that I see in the state's brief is exactly what was condemned by the Supreme Court of the United States. In Fenwick and all of the ex post facto cases, what they condemned was the fact that the law was changed by the governing body to make the burden less for the state, which makes convictions easier. And that's really what's happening here is that our position is that under the case law, and we have cited the court to a Houston Court of Appeals case, the state basically says, well, they think the language is confusing, and then they say, well, if it isn't, it's just wrong. Well, that may be I think it's kind of a disingenuous argument. I don't think the Court of Appeals in Houston stuttered. What they said in specific, and I bold pointed it in my brief, the lack of any eyewitness is what is meant in Article 3807 by uncooperated testimony. So I don't think there's anything really particularly confusing or unclear about that. Here, there simply was no cooperating testimony by any other eyewitness. There just wasn't. What the state has indeed brought up is some really lesser type of evidence. I don't even know it's circumstantial because they're saying, well, he sent cards and letters that sounded like they were lovers. He used a dildo, she says, although nobody else says that. And again, it's not cooperated. So I think on the first point, first of all, our position is that the court simply has a burden, according to the state of Texas, for the United States Supreme Court to acquit him on counts 7 through 10. Now, In the second point, and what I would also add, is that 3807 applies to all 15 counts. I mean, it's not limited to that. Whatever version you're trying to use, it still applies to all of those. In the second count that we have raised, there is a mandatory provision that the court instruct the jury as to the time lapse between the offense and the outcry, and that has to do with credibility of the witness. What we have raised in that issue is that it was not a discretionary type of function on the court. It was fundamental error. And like any other fundamental error, it's whether it's in an indictment, you don't have to raise it by an objection because it's fundamental. It's like jurisdiction. Here, the Texas legislature deemed it necessary to say, well, you have to instruct. And they just didn't do it. And they didn't do it not only on 7 through 10, they didn't do it on any counts at all. So on the second point, we believe that the matter should be reversed for a new trial because the trial court failed to apply the mandatory provisions of 3807. Now, in regard to, if I may, I just walked in the door.
What is our harm analysis on that?
I'm sorry, Your
Honor. What is our harm analysis on that? Egregious harm?
Yes, I think it's egregious harm because since we didn't, it's kind of double-fold. Since we didn't have corroborating evidence in the form of an eyewitness that was required by 3807, at least that should have applied according to the Supreme Court of the United States, in addition to that, not only do we not have cooperation, but we don't have the instruction that's mandated to question the credibility of that witness. Now, one of the things we're dealing with a lot of these cases is they were dealing with very, very young children, children under five, that sort of thing, and that was part of the reasoning for 3807. Here, we've dealt with a person who was not a five-year-old child. She was 14 or 15 years old at the time of some of these acts, and at the time she testified, she was 19 years old. That leads in and segues into our third point, where we want to revisit the fact that this court has ruled that touching pubic hair is part of the genital area. Now, the 19-year-old complainant in this case was perfectly capable of defining sexual anatomy. She did so in the trial several times, referred to erections, referred to various things like that. And yet, when it came to the act, she was very vague and just said, it touched my genital area in one point, and in the other point, she said, he touched the pubic hair. This court has defined pubic hair as being part of that genital area. I have searched, and in my briefing, I can find of no other court that has held that. To the contrary, the Court of Criminal Appeals had held that it was the vulva and that area, the other sexual parts. Lastly, if I may just quickly get to it, we have a void for vagueness argument as far as the two statutes. Basically, both statutes track each other. It's the same elements. It's the same everything. And it also involves a child under 17 years of age. The only difference is that one statute is a felony where they mention under 14. The other statute is a second degree. We're talking about a first degree felony and then a second degree felony, so it's a lesser type of thing. What is condemned in the case law is that the governing the law enforcement agencies can pick and choose. And that's our argument on that. Thank you very much.
On your issue number four, are you arguing that would require reversal or acquittal of all the counts as opposed to just seven?
Just reversal.
Okay, just reversal.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Nouse. Mr. Orbison?
May it please the court, Counselor. To try and address what the Chief Justice asked for, I think the big picture here is we're on remand from the Supreme Court of the United States. That's where we are. We're back in time to roughly the year 2000, at which point the Supreme Court of the United States has reversed this court on the issue of whether the 1993 amendment to the 3807 was in play for the earlier counts in this 15-count indictment. That's where we are. And the reason we're here is because through a long and tortured procedural history, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans said that he was denied the effective assistance of counsel at the time when this court initially considered the case on remand. So that's where we are. We're here to consider what the Supreme Court did and how it remanded the case to this court. And to read from the Supreme Court case, for these reasons, we hold the petitioner's convictions on counts 7 through 10 insofar as they are not corroborated by other evidence cannot be sustained under the ex post facto clause. Then later, we reverse, remand it for further proceedings not inconsistent with this opinion. It is rather clear to anyone who reads the case that the Supreme Court reversed this court's opinion as to whether there was an ex post facto clause violation relative to counts 7 through 10 in the 15-count indictment. That's what we're here to consider. We're not here to consider whether the statutes at the time were constitutionally vague. We're not here to reconsider things that this court considered in its original opinion, but were not reviewed by the Supreme Court. We're not here to consider any points of error other than 7 through 10 as it pertains to whether to ex post facto violation. Okay, now as to waiver, if the state had in its original briefing to this court back in 1997, that's when we briefed it, by the way, I erroneously, and I apologize for this, I think I used the year 1997 a time or two in the brief in reference to this court's original opinion, which was in fact in 1998, so I apologize for that. The briefing was done in 97. At any rate, had we argued at that time that there was no corroboration, it would have been an alternative argument. We often make those, not always. If, you know, speaking from the state's perspective, if we're fairly sure of our primary argument, we feel less compelled to make an alternative argument to this court. And at that time, under the law that exists, the case law that the state cited and this court agreed with, we felt that the 3807 was more of a procedural rule rather than an evidentiary rule, and this court agreed. So we could have said then, by the way, there was corroboration, but it would have been an alternative argument. So counsel is really attempting to convince this court that we have somehow waived the proper resolution of this issue by not making an alternative argument back in its original briefing. It was made in the briefing to the Supreme Court, but as the Supreme Court noted, and properly so, that this court had not considered the issue of whether there was corroboration. This court had simply said 3807, we can apply the 1993 amendment to all the indictments because it was basically a change in procedure and not in evidence. And therefore, this court didn't consider originally whether there was, in fact, cooperation. Clearly there was. Clearly this court pointed that out in its remand opinion. And those facts are not, as counsel would suggest, insignificant and minor. There was quite a bit of cooperation, as this court pointed out in its remand opinion, and as the state certainly believes as well.
What about his allegation that there has to be eyewitness cooperation?
Well, that comes from Heckethorn, which I still say, I mean, you know, he says the court didn't stumble. Well, all I can say to that is the Court of Criminal Appeals certainly didn't stutter or stumble when it clearly said that the issue of corroboration is that which tends to connect the defendant with the offense, and it can be proved through eyewitness. That's one way. It also could be proved a number of other ways, including circumstantially. Clearly, the law does not require and has never required, even back then, that corroboration equals eyewitness testimony. Now, as to what in the heck Heckathorne was saying, I'm not really sure. I will note though, that in a later case in Jones, which opposing counsel also cites, Jones itself seems to suggest that what Heckathorne was talking about was all dicta and not necessary to its holding in the case. So you might want to read it's the 14th District's later case language in Jones to figure out what they were saying in Heckathorne. Clearly, they weren't presented with the issue of what kind of evidence corroborates in Heckathorne. They were concerned with outcry, and obviously the outcry rule today is a lot different than it was back then, because we were actually talking about three outcry witnesses in Heckathorne, as opposed to today, as we all know, there's one outcry witness. So, rather than attempt to explain Heckathorne, I just note that the law is pretty clear from the Court of Criminal Appeals as to what corroboration exists of, and it's not exclusively eyewitness testimony. And I did cite in my brief a couple of cases that agree with that, that also kind of scratched their head about what Heckathorne said. As to the jury charge issue, which is number two, what the courts say is exactly opposite to what opposing counsel suggested. There are a number of cases from this time period which say it's simply not reversible error when that charge under 3807 was missing, even though it was statutorily required under the pre-1993 amendment. Where it was missing in other cases, several Court of Criminal Appeals opinions have held it was simply not reversible error where the defense did not bring the court's attention to its omission in the charge. Now, once again, we're faced with how would we look at that case today as opposed to how they looked at it back then, but clearly it seems to me that by saying it was not reversible or fundamental error, they were really would be today's equivalent of egregious harm. So no objection, got to show egregious harm, and I think that is, although they didn't call it that then, but that was the analysis.
But do you agree if we found that there was no need for cooperation, no need for the instruction because of the fact that there was substantial cooperation, then is this issue even relevant?
No. None of these issues. The only issue that's relevant to this court and that this court really should even entertain is issue one, which is really three issues. And I'm only addressing issue two simply because opposing counsel did, and I can't look into the judicial mind and see if you're going to agree with me ultimately. But issue two should not be considered by the court. And even if it's going to be considered, clearly the Dallas case cited in the state's brief said, hey, where there's substantial cooperation, 3807 doesn't apply. I do want to address one erroneous thing that I heard. And he said 3807 applies to all the counts. Well, yeah, but which version? So all the counts before 1993, we would have the 3807 that existed before 1993. And so that is those are the counts to which the jury instruction would apply. All the counts after 1993, there was no jury instruction included in the statute. So I would submit that it's not the same version. Well, that's what the Supreme Court said. It's not the same version of 3807 that applies to all the counts here. I would ask the court if it has any particular questions or concerns it's interested in.
Mr. Arbison, I do.
Okay, yes, sir.
Would you focus for a moment on the language that is in the opinion that was rendered by the Fifth Circuit? I'm talking about the closing language on the last page. That's under Roman numeral 3, because I'm hearing you say, I missed your argument, that we're still looking at corroboration on counts 7 through 10 as an issue.
Yes, I guess.
All right.
All right, go ahead.
And then what the court's saying here is now being the Fifth Circuit in relation to the habeas corpus matter. We reverse the district court's judgment denying habeas corpus relief and remand the case to the district court for entry of a judgment granting habeas corpus relief on counts 7 through 10. If we stop there, what does that say?
Well, we can't stop there. That's the key.
If we stop there, what does it say? That's saying 7 through 10.
Yes, sir.
We're granting habeas relief, and we're saying on 7 through 10, there's an acquittal.
But we can't stop there, Your Honor.
So we don't
stop
there.
And the reason... And the reason.
I don't want to stop
okay.
there. Unless the state affords Carmel an out-of-time appeal with the assistance of counsel. So the unless then applies, and their ruling, their statement that we're sending it to the district court for entry of an acquittal doesn't apply because we've granted an out-of-time appeal. Now, within the subject of the out-of-time appeal, then we go right back, don't we, to the language in the Supreme Court opinion in remanding the case. And the Supreme Court opinion is addressing 7 through 10, aren't they?
Exactly
so
right.
So that's all we're looking at. Is
exactly. I agree with everything you're saying.
So I'm just trying to be careful that I'm focusing on the state's position here. And so in looking at 7 through 10, the evidence that was presented that's in the record for the trial that happened back, the trial was
96.
Was the evidence we're to look at in terms of any issue about corroboration, the evidence that was before the court only at that trial?
Absolutely.
All right. And then how is it that we can go past the ruling in the courts that the corroboration issue was not appropriate for the second opinion of this court, not the first, but the second? Whenever that opinion is thrown out because of ineffective assistance of counsel.
I was totally with you to that last point.
Here's what I'm looking for. What's the law of the case in terms of the corroboration evidence that was presented at the first trial?
As to the corroboration, as to an appellate ruling on the corroboration evidence,
yes.
I don't think there is any law of the case except as you're about to create it. Now, because I can't tell you, we go back to your opinion on remand, and say that's law of the case, because that's the very issue that is under this, that is live in this reinstated appeal.
All right, so, it would be,
so there is no law of the case as to corroboration evidence.
All right. In terms of the remand decision that was the subject of the writ of habeas corpus proceedings and the ruling by the Fifth Circuit, we are not looking at any law that was announced in the remanded decision from the Supreme Court in our 2000 opinion as being a part of the law of the case.
Right. It's not law of the case, but it's folly to say you can't look at it.
No,
because
I'm just talking about where we are in terms of this court's current position on what we're addressing.
Yes. That, I don't think you can consider the remand opinion as law of the case, and the state has not argued that you should.
All right. Thank you.
But at the same time, you don't have to stick your head in the sand and not even – because there is the cooperation. I mean, why go back and reinvent the wheel when you've got it laid out right there? May I finish it? Just one thought.
Yes, thank you.
But it's not law of the case. That is precisely what you're here to do. It's as though you never had that remand opinion, and we are now – he's now represented by counsel, and we're both here advocating, and you are to make a decision on remand from the Supreme Court.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The
state would pray that you affirm this conviction.
Thank you, Mr. Orbison. Mr. Nass, rebuttal?
Thank you. I did find the part in the United States Supreme Court decision that I wanted to read to you, if I may, because I think it is, as was stated, the law of the case. It comes on page 519. It's in footnote 4. It said, the state argues that there is evidence corroborating the victim's testimony, so it does not help petitioner even if the old law applies. Before the state court, however, petitioner argued that there was nothing to corroborate the victim's version of events. And the court's notes, the court, talking about this court, accepted the contention as correct for the purpose of its decision. We do the same thing here. So I think what the United States Supreme Court said is this court, they interpreted your decision back in 97 or 98 as being a determination that there was no cooperation because it was never talked about by the state, and this court assumed or apparently accepted in its opinion that there was no cooperation. At least the Supreme Court of the United States believes that's what you did, and that's what they dealt with in reversing it to you. Now, secondly, in regard to in rebuttal, he cited the Jones case that I cited. And what the Jones case says is, having reviewed the statute and the case law construing it, we find that Heckathorn's construction of 3807, although unnecessary to the holding in that case, because the victim wasn't 14 or over in that case, is the most logical interpretation of the plain language of the statute. So the Jones case did unequivocally state that they thought Heckathorn was the proper law, and they applied it in Jones by saying that under 3807, where they had a 14-year-old victim, there was a requirement for cooperation, and Heckathorn said cooperation has to be by eyewitness testimony. That's what they accepted. So that there are at least two cases that say that. I would submit to the court, though, that as I said in the opening argument, the Supreme Court, while it mentioned only from an ex post facto basis that it was reversing or dealing with points 7 through 10, because that is what was dealt with as far as when the statute was effective, the 1993 statute, it did not address the rest of the things involved in the case, and I think it would be ludicrous to say that, you know, you can't consider because you can. Thank you very much. We would ask for acquittal on 7 through 10 and a reversal on all other counts.
Mr. Nass, we appreciate your arguments and your briefing. Mr. Orbison, we appreciate the state's briefing and arguments as well. That concludes the submissions for this morning. If the clerk will now adjourn us.
All right.